I blundered into the Peace Corps Library in Maseru, and I found the original Permaculture 1 and 2. And really quite by accident, I found out that Bill Mollison was coming to South Africa to do a two-week permaculture design course.
Hello, and welcome to the Permaculture Vine podcast. Today, we welcome Ivan Yaholnitsky to the show. Welcome, Ivan.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you. Ivan, do you just want to give us a quick, short introduction just before we start?
Yeah, I was born in 1958 in Canada, Western Canada, on a grain farm. And I guess during my childhood, there was a transition in agriculture in the West from, you know, smallholder agriculture to agribusiness. You know, it was a fundamental shift, you know, in the way people, saw themselves, but I lived through that transition. I had a very privileged background, upbringing in Canada, prosperous society gave me a good education, and had the opportunity to start a technical and commercial school, partially in relation to what I saw about permaculture.
And that's where you've been ever since.
Thought this was such a fabulous vehicle for transforming societies and creating a positive condition of life. But I had technical skills to be able to do it. You needed to be able to build new processing skills. So fortunately, I had met the director not that far from us in Ficksburg, South Africa, which is about, you know, 300-400 kilometers from where we were. And when I found out about that, I just said, no, I'm absolutely not going to miss this. So in February 1997, I took the PDC with Bill Mollison at Rustler's Valley. And it was a fantastic experience. You know, he was there himself.
Wow, that's amazing. Could you tell us more about that PDC? What was covered? How was built? And things like that?
Well, you know, again, what was amazing is that there was a very small group, maybe 25 or 30 people. And actually only a handful of us knew who he was. You know, the rest of the people on the course had been sent there or seconded, because somebody else thought that it would be important or good for them to go. So really there was only a handful of us that knew who he was. And, you know, he just sat there and in bare feet and talked brilliantly for two weeks. And of course there were some assignments, some mapping and things like that, but it was a fabulous experience. I mean, I met people there, lifelong friends that I still am in contact with today.
Yeah, I heard that in the last podcast we did as well. On our feed, basically, the friends you meet at the PDC become lifelong contacts. So doing that PDC with Bill, did you look back then on what you've been practicing so far? Was there anything that stood out as a big mistake or things you were doing right up to that point?
No, not really. I mean, he was a very eclectic thinker, Bill. I remember asking him if it would be a good idea to import beavers to South Africa because we've got a catastrophic runoff and erosion problem. And, you know, he said he thought it was a good idea. And also just again, to go on with the story, in about 1990 or so, no, sorry, I'm getting my dates mixed up here now. About in 2000, you know, 3-4 years after I did the PDC, of course, I applied to Bill for a diploma. I sent him a dossier and he sent me back this beautiful diploma in permaculture. And also at that time, about 3 or 4 years after I did the PDC, I went to Canada on a trip to visit my family. And I realized that I didn't have enough of a grasp on some of the fundamental science of atmospheric science, you know, to be able to really know the numbers. So I picked up two books. I by accident called a professor of environment and asked, well, what book should a person read? And he gave me these two references, Atmospheric Ecology for Designers and Planners by William P. Lowry and Boundary Layer Climates by T.R. Oak. And I read these books from cover to cover, and they were fabulous. You know, they really solidified my understanding of how an ecosystem works, and you know, the mass transfer, you know, the term, the mass transfer of the biosphere is all atmospheric. It came out of that, out of those readings. And, you know, that is such a profound realization for me that you can just really go any place, the most decrepit kind of bad soil, and you can rebuild it with good practices, water, pioneer plants, just putting in those little nudges that set everything in motion.
And what was the big takeaway out of them two books? Because honestly, atmosphere and climate, it's probably beyond my knowledge.
Well, you know, for me, at that time, I wrote a little summary. I called it Sun, Water, and Life. You know, and because we actually had when we started the technical school in 93, we specialized in solar technology, and we had a little bit of an advantage there, where we were moving on solar technology at a time when no one else was even thinking about it. So I say these books and permaculture and design thinking really connected sun, water, and life for me. These three fundamental forces that you can harness in a permaculture system. Because I, again, one of my criticisms of some of the permaculture is it kind of restricts itself to what I call messy gardening. And that's not enough. We need to really look at the built environment, all aspects of how we've put together civilization. And that, to me, that's really the big drawing card of permaculture, is to think in large terms and put all the big pieces together as well as the small ones.
Yeah, the more I talk to people, the more you sort of discover these things. Like there are permacultures out there, like doing governance, studying governance, how we should govern ourselves, and getting away from that messy gardening. It's just not as relevant, or it's just not as in your face. I think it all starts with the garden. So what kind of like you mentioned gardening, what kind of sort of gardening and farming have you been doing up to this point? And did it change after you
well,
got
I
your
love
PDC?
Gardening. Well, I love gardening myself. We have a very large backyard garden. We do a lot of food preservation in the house. By, you know, in Canada, we're snowed under for 6 months of the year. And Lesotho has a beautiful climate. There's brassicas, cabbages, greens that grow right through the winter. It's a beautiful climate.
And you mentioned
and one of the things which again, yeah, you know, it's been evolving. We have earthworms on our campus, which I never see anywhere in Lesotho. I mean, I travel all over Lesotho, and believe it or not, it's taken them these 30 years to spread. They move very, very slowly. We have a paved lane through the campus. And you know what, again, in humid environments, after rainfall, the earthworms will come out onto the road. And our campus, as far as I know, is the only place in Lesotho where the road is covered with earthworms in the morning. Like 2 days ago, we had 20 millimeters of rain overnight, and the lane was covered with earthworms. But the spread is actually quite slow. They've still not reached, they've probably only moved about, I don't know, 40 or 50 meters from my home each way on the lane.
Right. And did you place the earthworms there? Did they arrive?
Well, not really. They probably came in with some nursery materials that I bought at nursery. So sometimes you would buy a tree or something in a plant bag, and you take the tree out and you see, oh, there's some earthworms there. So they would always be in the compost or something like that. And
yeah,
I guess that, you know, that was the nucleus spread. I don't know if they were there originally. I really wouldn't know. Again, you don't see them. And I do a certain amount of mining. I pick them up off the road and put them in jars, and I spread them out. Again, I don't really have too much time to follow up and monitor how they're doing, but I do that on occasion.
Yeah, that's fascinating the way that they've spread from some nursery stock. So taking it to 2000, you got your diploma from Bull. What was next? Did you use that diploma for anything, or did you start? Do you want to take us from that point?
Well, you know, as a developer of a school, I've had to build lots of buildings. Goodness gracious, I've built probably 30, 40, 50 buildings, you know, some large, some small, houses, classrooms, you know, the biggest 200-300 square meters. And, you know, design thinking is the difference between getting something which really works quite well and something which doesn't work at all. You know, really, it forces you to think about the orientation of the building, the placement of the building, things like access, wind, solar radiation aspect, water runoff, you know, subsequent vegetation. Again, no one does it. As Bill Mollison said again and again, you know, no one designs. Everybody comes along playing their own tune.
Yeah, so that's, you have 30, you have all them buildings in the school, in the college.
Pardon me.
So you built all them buildings in the college, did you, in the school?
Yes, with the students, you know, right. Year by year, exactly. Every year we would add something. 2 years ago, we built an earthship, nice building. About 220 square meters. It's an earth sheltered building. It has a beautiful solar orientation, warms up beautifully in the morning from the sun. And we used about 800 or 900 used tires filled with earth. And the south and west walls are bermed up to roof height.
Wow, so you are doing an awful lot of stuff there. That's great. So you have the college, the school, you do the solar, the building, the farming. Do you do anything else in the, do you want to tell me about the, what you do at the school as well?
Well, you know, it's a integrated curriculum. You know, at the end of that book on atmospheric ecology by William P. Lowry, he's got this great, you know, it's not an academic book as such. It was a guy just sitting down and I think coalescing all of his thoughts. And, you know, it's a book written a long time ago. Again, I think published in 1988, same year as a designer's manual. And he concludes by saying, you must be the generalist, the activist, the doer. And it's a kind of a pep talk, pushing people to get out there and grapple with these great global issues of sustainable development. You could see he was on that trajectory, but obviously probably too old at a state, but he was passing that baton to everybody in the world very much. And, you know, even in education, so you're fighting an uphill battle. Training people to be generalists, which is what we do. So that I'm coming now to what we do at the school. We have a very broad curriculum. The students can take 4 subjects out of 8: solar technology, building construction, metalwork, woodwork, food science and culinary arts, business and IT, travel and tourism, and environmental science. And it's hands-on project-based learning for 2 years.
I would have liked to have went to school to get. That sounds fantastic. And I take it the students are all local students?
Yes, from all over Lesotho. Although we've had a lot of international interns over the years. We've had probably 15 or 20 people coming from overseas, from all around the world, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, something like that, because they hear about us and they're interested in this cultural and economic movement that we're a part of.
So if somebody wanted to be an intern for 6 months to come and learn from me, how does that process work?
Just email me and send a CV and just sort of a letter of again, we the school is fairly well structured. There's a board. There's some due process. I can't make all decisions myself, but we do welcome interns and make space for them when we can.
Right. So take it the because we talk about like so that's covering the education piece in your career. How do you get the funding for the college, for the school? How do you keep the school going? How do you get it funded? Yeah.
Well, that's a really good question. You know, we're one of the few organizations that have broken out and have I call them these three hot dog trolleys. We run a lodge, we run a construction company, and we run a solar company, and we really do quite well financially running all of that. We're not dependent on grants or outside funding. At a certain point there, I don't know about, it wasn't easy, I can tell you, but somewhere there around about 10 years ago, we broke out into the clear. Like to tell you a little bit about my life, it's kind of, I'm right in the midst of a good role right now. Yesterday, I actually picked up an electric scooter that we bought in Maseru. It's in a crate, just something that we want to use and see how it works in the solar energy program. My technician from the solar company is in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, today, picking up a pallet of 550-watt solar panels, 31 panels. So we do that commercially, also solar water heaters. And then at the school, we have a lodge and a full-service restaurant. We can host about 20 visitors. And because we're very remote and kind of on a hub point, we're busy. We're busy. Busy with travel and tour institutional visitors that use. So those three hot dog trolleys, as I call them, they give us a significant cash flow.
Yeah, really.
And also, obviously, the farm Cormac and the Self Alliance. I mean, we've got these very elaborate water system set up. We have several water supplies. We're close to a stream. We have three groundwater dams, sand dams on that stream, each with a solar pump. We produce 7 or 8,000 liters of solar hot water each day, and we produce something like 150 or 160 kilowatt hour of solar power a day because we're off grid. So the contribution of self-reliance to the financial, self-sustainability of the organization is substantial.
I think that's fantastic the way you have them sources, the 4 or 5 different sources of income there. And I like the way you are sort of self-sufficient in that way. And it's a really good way. I think it's for modeling this into the future, permaculture businesses have to be operate that way. Otherwise, it's not sustainable because you're constantly
maybe a 2% gradient, but you still have overland long swales across the field, and you know, shape them at first with a plow, just with a tractor, and then with by hand, then some deepening that halted the overland water flow across that field. I mean, two nights ago we had 20 millimeters of rain. It was, although it was cold night rain, but still the topmost swale intercepted all that water. And, you know, a staggering amount of water. And we planted as a windbreak pine trees across the top of the field to get them going quickly. And, you know, they're just going like a bullet into the sky right now because of the extra water they get. And, you know, we don't need to water them.
Right. So you're using your design skills and experience from what you've learned now to do this for your daughter and build her the 2 hectare parcel land. Do you do designs for commercially or?
I've been asked to do it. You know, we're in the Sutu, so you don't have people with, you know, vast resources. So unfortunately, as many times as I've tried to do that, it's not something which is lucrative. It's not the right kind of a market where you have people with you know, really ample resources who are willing to invest and put money into something like this. I always laugh when I first got involved in permaculture. I thought, well, this is just going to go like wildfire. Everywhere we go, we'll see people A-framing, digging swales, but we're still waiting for the revolution to come.
Yeah, I thought it would have happened quicker as well, even with the last couple of years, all the chaos. But no, I think it's getting slightly more popular. I'm not sure how long it'll take before it goes completely mainstream.
Yeah, I think it will. You know, again, another little interesting note is that there's a lot of talk about how COVID hammered the world economy and stuff like that. We just marched right through COVID. Although it did affect us, the school was closed, we were wearing masks and this and that, but it did not affect us at all financially like other organizations and institutions. We kept paying salaries. We didn't slow down at all through COVID.
Yeah, that's great. That shows a lot of resilience you have. So what's next on the agenda for you? Have you seen any plans for the next few years?
Just to keep going. My daughter's farm is evolving. It's a market garden farm. She plants a variety of crops on it. So I want to help her there. There's huge potential for using sand and groundwater dams in Lesotho for watershed management. They work beautifully in this environment where you've got a lot of coarse sediment going down the streams. We've done several groundwater dams around Lesotho, 3 for ourselves, 4 or 5 elsewhere. I've been saying Lesotho should be building 10,000 a year. They're very cheap and simple and inexpensive to do because all of the materials are in site, on site. You need some gabions and, you know, solar technology is one of those wild cards that has become much more accessible and available in the last 5 or 10 years. You know, price of solar panels has tumbled. So distributed energy is not exotic. Well, of course, yeah, the price is right. The technology is robust, ready for scaling and rollout, especially for decentralization of economic opportunity. Because, you know, you can go now just about any place in the world and in a few minutes set up a powerful power system that can run your machines, your electronics, your fridges, all of this sort of stuff that you need, infrastructure for a small farm.
With Starlink now, it's great too for remote areas. I don't know if you get that there. The satellites, Starlink satellite internet?
Not yet. We have, yeah, not yet. I heard that they were coming to South Africa. I don't know what the situation is in Lesotho. We have fairly good, like I'm in town right now. I'm not at Bethel. So you can see we're struggling a bit with data networks as it is. So, but there has been a steady improvement in data networks.
I suppose all you can ask is it goes in the right direction. In your 30 years now in Lesotho, I was going to say, like, well, how can someone, if someone was looking to get to where you are now, what advice would you have for them? I know it's going to take a long time and you've built a lot of things there, but would you have any advice to share for someone who's sort of inspired by yourself and who would look to repeat it?
Well, you need some space, obviously. And again, one of the really astonishing things that we're living through in a place like Lesotho right now is we're having a crisis of internal migration. You know, your villages are collapsing. We had terrible droughts between 2015 and 2020. We had a string of terrible spring rain failures. So people are draining out of the rural areas and villages and piling into town. And of course, putting stress on the political economy, which just can't respond to it. So, you know, again, I always encourage people to go against the flow. If people are rushing into town, go the other way. But again, it's a tough message to sell to people. But I think the opportunity and the potential is there. The other thing I just wanted to also mention, I'm actually a social scientist. That's what I studied in university. About 15 or 20 years ago, I read a book called Democracy and Development in Africa by Claude Aké, a Nigerian. He was one of those people that lost their life somehow tragically in that plane crash many, many years ago. But it's a book still worth reading because he really nails the situation of democracy and development in Africa and how the expectations of the state really were unrealistic. And again, this is the problem we're facing in a place like Lesotho, where people are looking for government, a formal institution, structures to provide more than they can possibly ever provide. So, you know, we need decentralization, we need permaculture, we need small, intentional communities. They can just get going. There's nothing to stop them.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of decentralization myself, empowering people, whether it's growing food or taking care of themselves, but it seems to be there's a rush to centralize things to make a profit off them, and you just have to take that back yourself.
Well, exactly. You know, we have our graduation coming up on June 16th. And, you know, the notion of self-employment, that mindset, you know, people want jobs. But as you know, anywhere in the world, jobs come with such enormous restrictions. You know, an employer can never provide a job description that suits each and every human being. And there's just no way that people can emerge into any form working in a job. I mean, we can have jobs, but we need to have centers of life elsewhere. You know, self-reliance in permaculture, creating value. I mean, there's so much scope for, you know, pottering about your yard and your small holding or whatever it is, and being cheerfully occupied. For me, it's just an infinite scope for that sort of self-fulfillment.
Yeah, and I think we have to just showcase these examples and show people that there is a way that you can work for yourself. You can be self-reliant. You can grow your own food. It's one of our aims here on the podcast is to demonstrate these systems and way of living to other people so that you can earn your career doing what you love, as well as providing a lot of value to your communities.
Exactly. In terms of production, again, thinking about the graduation, what I was going to tell, say to the students, you can, people say, well, produce what? Well, you can produce energy, you can produce water, you can produce good soil. There's just so much that you can achieve by orienting yourself to some sort of production. Productive engagement with space.
Yeah, that is. So if I was now to start as I'm a PDC graduate, a couple of years in, would you have any advice for someone in that position? Would you write how do you start to get into self-employment?
Exactly. And to get good basic skills, good basic construction and shop skills, which somehow I myself fumbled upon. But to me, that is just really the key. And as in permaculture courses, there is always some skill building done, but it's probably not enough. One of the wonders of the global economy is that it provides us all of these modular systems for construction, for solar energy, for getting a farm going, systems of irrigation. But you need some technical skills, some shop skills, like a workshop, being handy. And that's really not that difficult to learn. Welding, basic carpentry, basic construction skills. Tomorrow morning I'm going to be pouring concrete. I'm involved in a little building project here next door. It's just something I picked up. I love doing it. I've never seen anybody, a student, ever not like tables and materials. They just, I can also say, as a teacher, chalking and talking and using this kind of symbol analysis, but basically, when we go to work, there's always a stampede for the door from
Oh, the
behind the desk.
yeah. Yeah, I'd rather be outside myself. Ivan, is there anything else you'd we haven't covered that you'd like to chat about?
Well, obviously, I suppose the challenge of our time, which is quite severe, climate change, sustainable
Yeah, I've lost you again. I think the data is bad again there.
unrest, the levels of urban cost, the human cost. It's something I think deeply about, and I think we need to be rolling out better alternatives, better pathways for emergence from this malaise. I do as much as I can, but I think we need a much broader movement to embrace something like permaculture and really give it life and give it an outlet, because we need it. We desperately need it. It's not something that's some sort of a luxury that we can sort of dabble at. If we don't do it, we will just simply lose the plot.
Yeah, I think some would say we've already lost the plot.
Well, yeah, of course. I follow the doomers on Twitter, so we've got this great global debate of whether it's all lost already, or is there any hope? I mean, I'm not one of the doomers. I do what I can. To me, the biosphere will help us. We have these vast arid regions of the earth that can be restored. We can shift all that excess carbon from the air into the soil and all that excess water from the seas onto land. I mean, to me, it's doable. We haven't even touched a fraction of the percentage of doing it. We're not going to scale on that. And we need to do this at the highest levels, from top to bottom.
We have to do it, but I think we just all have to show examples, and they'll take the pioneers, the ones who are out there doing it. You've been doing it for a long time. I think there's more people doing it now, and to me, that's the positive thing. So it's not about it's doom. There's enough doing it, and hopefully it has that compounding effect that slowly but surely it'll lead to the mass adoption of permaculture and people realizing that they can do things themselves and realizing you can't, the governments aren't going to, the world, I don't think, are going to fix this. They're not going to change it because they've vested interest. It's up to the people to lead it from the bottom up.
Exactly. I said Jeff Lott deserves a Nobel Prize. Something like that would raise the profile of what he's doing and what the permaculture movement has the potential to achieve globally.
Yeah, he's doing some amazing projects. The Green in the Desert is crazy that they see the growth in his place and then the desert outside it. It's quite a contrast.
Well, I see we're coming to the end of our hour. I want to thank you really very sincerely for giving me this opportunity to speak. I hope it made some sense to you and your listeners.
Ivan, I'm sure they'll be blown away. I'm going to have to come back and we'll have to have another interview at some stage and dive deeper into all the individual things that you're doing. If you would like that would be great.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's good that a couple of weeks ago, I didn't even know that vine permaculture existed. And now I know we have to build these networks and expand them and strengthen them, get other people involved.
By talking and sharing, I think that's how we make the steps forward. Ivan, thank you very much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, my pleasure, Cormac. Good luck with everything.
All right. And for the listeners here, thanks very much. I'll leave Ivan's details in the show notes. So if you want to go and have a look there and see what he's up to, and he's on Twitter and a few other ones as well. So you'll be able to chat to him on Twitter if you want to find out more. I'll chat to you all next week. Cheers.